This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
She's bad, she's beautiful, and she's back. She's Pam Grier, and when a woman's this hot, you can never get enough.
How about that?
Now, catch this sexy star in five of her hottest films. Coffee, Sheba Baby, Foxy Brown, Friday Foster, and Scream, Blackula Scream. She's got something for everyone.
And she's our guest on Fresh Air. Pam Grier was the queen of the black exploitation films of the 70s, doing battle with pushers and pimps. She was a sexy, tough-talking, two-fisted, sharpshooting action hero years before women action heroes were common in mainstream movies. You might also know Pam Grier from her roles as a drugged-out killer prostitute in Fort Apache, the Bronx, and as Philip Michael Thomas's love interest in Miami Vice. Pam Grier is in the new film, Class of 1999. It's written and directed by Mark Lester, who also did Class of 1984. In 1999, the schools have become war zones, ruled by violent gangs. Grier plays a military-designed combat android, which is reprogrammed to educate and discipline students. I asked her if playing a demented authority figure was a change for her.
No, I've played dementia before, actually.
What about authority figures, though?
An authority figure, yes. However, even though we're demented, we are also not human. The figure is a strong figure, and I like to variate between my roles from a very, not passive, but very soft and feminine and a little less strong. And this one is in a robotic, which was interesting because we had to work with and be compatible with our computer technology, which is somehow very mechanic in the film. It is a departure for me in the last, 5 years because I've played less physical roles.
How did you get this role? And I'm wondering if the director knew all of your films.
Yes, he did. Mark Lester was quite familiar with my work and had seen me for some of his other films that he was doing. And he thought I had the physicality to carry some of the 80 pounds of apparatus as a robotic that you wear. And he liked my work, and next thing I know, I had the role.
Do you feel that you're still typecast?
No, but I know I'm usually on that top of the list of someone that could, you know, play a physical woman, such as someone in a police force or a detective. The roles I'm getting, like in Crime Story, I played on television, which was a series for NBC, as a journalist. I'm developing two dramas for series for network are less physical, and there's a comedy that's also being developed, and that there's no physical physicality in that. I did a play called Fool for Love, the Sam Shepard play in Los Angeles for 5 months. Something Wicked This Way Comes, it was different. So I think it's up to me as the actress to kind of choose and select the roles, but I know that they know I'm very strong, very physical. I'm an athlete, and I do a lot of things that I can use in film, such as being a certified diver, I ski, I'm in rodeos, so I know they're going to call me as someone who can do something very physical and have an acting ability. So I've honed skills on both sides, the physical and my acting craft.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk with you about some of the blaxploitation films that you were in the beginning of your career. I know when I interviewed the filmmakers Robert Townsend and Keenan Ivory Wayans, they both said that those black action films were really important to them because it was the first time where there was a black hero and he got to get the girl at the end. He wasn't just the asexual sidekick. Yeah. And I was wondering if you felt you had an equivalent effect for women watching the movies.
Oh, absolutely. Not only was it our images in front of the camera, we had craftsmen and technicians who got in the unions, which are now, which was very difficult to do, and now there are people who are within the business who can, you know, form production companies of their own and who've learned how to do films. So all around, it was very important on the technical side and the artistic side. For me, The films that I did, Coffee, Foxy Brown, and Sheba, were based on the women, the female characters in my family, who weren't very physical, but yet they were very strong women who had to keep a nice house. That's a part of our culture. A woman is complimented on keeping a nice house and taking care of all the kids and possibly having a job also. So these were very strong women, but yet trying to maintain a sense of femininity and just trying not to have a heart attack in the middle of it. And they were all based on, my characters were based on my aunt, my mom, my grandmother, and some of the other women that lived in the neighborhood, that if, you know, they would protect their children with, you know, physical violence if they had to. And I guess for any woman, I think any woman would, whether she's strong or not.
Of course, they didn't go around shooting men in the groin like your
characters
did.
No, but I bet you they would if someone tried to attack them. I know where their knee would go if someone would try to steal their purse or hurt one of their children. I know exactly where their knee would go, or a broom or a brick or a skillet.
What was your reaction to the Coalition Against Blaxploitation that was formed in 1972 by the NAACP and SCLIC and CORE? And these groups felt that the black exploitation films were creating bad role models for young black people.
Well, I think it was fair, but on the other hand, in the films, even though you had our villains, we still had a doctor. We had, my boyfriend was a doctor in one of the films, a detective. We had a wealthy industrialist who was African-American. They always, sometimes they see the heroine. I think what they were speaking of is if the villain became the hero at the end. In my films, that didn't happen, so I'm not sure if I was directly responsible for that type of backlash. But in a sense, what I was saying in my films, I wanted to reflect a lot of things that we were very hypocritical about in our black society. It was that I could see the growing danger of drug addiction and drug pushing and prostitution and the pimps that was growing in our community and becoming quite fashionable. You know, a lot of gangsters, a lot of people see that as being romantic and a way for people who are oppressed to glamorize themselves. They earn a living in a way that's different from most the norm, and young kids would see that, and no one would tell the child, well, no, this is entertaining, and you want to know why the child is there seeing those films. They're a little bit too young. The films that I did, and I'm sure the ones that Jim Brown and Fred Williamson and Richard Roundtree did, those are films for adults. However, the responsibility of the theater owners was a little lax because they allowed younger children with no supervision to come into the films and see them. So therefore, you've got children seeing images that no one tells them, well, no, this is not the image that you grow up to be. This is entertainment. These are the good guys, and these are the bad guys. If the bad guys win, then they'll want to be the bad guys, and that's not a good role model. But as far as the other people trying to do good, trying to help out the community, those were the images that I projected, and I think some of the others did also.
I think your first film was Black Mama, White Mama. Describe the part you played in that.
Well, it was a takeoff of a film that was done with Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis, Terry, called The Defiant Ones, right? And, what was it? Yeah,
yeah, The
Defiant Ones.
Where they're handcuffed together,
right,
and they're both prisoners?
So all of a sudden they did a female version of us escaping from a prison, defiantly trying to survive. So I guess, and it had a different title, Chains of Hate, right? Chains of Hate. And they changed it to Black Mama, White Mama. You know, I'm sure that was to pull in the box office. And it was about two women escape from prison, chained together, and how they help each other. And my co-star, Margaret Markoff, was a ballerina.
Well, I should say the story was co-written by Jonathan Demme.
Yes.
Who's now one of the famous American mm-hmm. filmmakers. One of his recent movies was Married to the Mob. Did you find that a lot of the actors and the writers or directors of these action films went on to establish...
Oh. Absolutely.
Different kinds of careers afterwards.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we all started with the school of Roger Corman, you know, to how to stretch a buck, you know, and really make it scream. When I was working for Roger, and I was really becoming more and more fascinated by the filmmaking process, I would go in the offices, and there would be Jonathan Demme, Jonathan Kaplan, George Lucas, Francis Coppola, Spielberg. There'd be all these people, you know, doing film, cutting film, collaborating, helping each other out, sharing hamburgers, and, you know, little did we know.
Now, there became, in your movies, I think, scenes you almost had to do in the films. I think it must have gotten to the point where you almost had to have a scene where you had a long, drawn-out series of fistfights with other women.
Yeah, I think that was some subtle, I don't know what you would call it on the air. I'm trying to find a better word for it. I don't know if it was on the part of the filmmaker or that they really like to see women be physical or do physical things or fight each other. I remember there were a lot of movies in the 50s where people really were excited to see women, you know, roll around the floor and fight. And I used to see it in my neighborhood, and I didn't like it. It used to bother me, you know, and it still bothers me. It's amazing because I have this strange contradiction. I have an aversion to violence, and I often look like Mary Poppins the way I dress, and I have that mentality. And then I'll do a film, and it's the antithesis of how I really feel. And it's physical, and it's violent. It's people screaming out in rage, and I think the way I do a film, I see it, and it's something that my mother and my grandparents used to say to me, before you cast stones, walk a mile in someone's shoes. So I think the roles that I play are, I try to play someone who has that rage and violence and try to do it well, and I don't think it's something that I just want to do in my career from film after film or that I had to do. I think I was the only one that was really good at it and made it look convincing. And when I walked away from it, it's just like something that, well, I don't even want to see it. I don't want to have much to do with it. And that's the way I've always been with violence. Even the film in Fort Apache, the Bronx, the scene with the razor blade. After I did that scene, I was very physically ill afterwards. I couldn't do a second take. Thank God I did it right the first time.
Let me get back to some of your films from the 70s. You know, we were talking about how there was a fight with women in several of the films. Mm. There was also castration scenes where you'd shoot somebody or have another way.
Must have been a metaphor.
Well, how did these end up being an almost trademark in your film?
Well, I think It wasn't to be taken seriously. The many of the scenes in the films weren't to be taken seriously. The castration was for people to. I think it was like a modern monster movie where you would see something so horrific and people would like, yeah, get them. That's what the bad guy deserves. He was such a bad guy, and people who have different imaginations will see different things from it. And I think the only castration scene possibly was in this movie, Foxy Brown had one. And it was basically tongue-in-cheek and a bunch of metaphors, and I never took it seriously.
Another thing is that in so many of your scenes, your clothes were draped in such a way, and you were positioned in such a way as to be the sexiest. So tell me what it was like when they would be positioning you so that you'd be showing off, you know, more cleavage or whatever.
You can't really hide my cleavage. It's just there, unfortunately. I was one of those well-endowed children. And I think, you know, all of that was exploited to sell tickets on behalf of the filmmakers.
Did that bother you, or did you just get into it because you knew that there was a certain camp value in this
also?
No,
it was camp, but it was also an age where nudity in the 70s, we were still riding that wave of, you know, that free love and romping around Woodstock naked and our bodies are beautiful and why should I be ashamed of my body and that. And black women were never appreciated as that woman on the podium. She wasn't in advertising as much. She wasn't considered as beautiful. And black men didn't have these, you know, these black female sexy images to also feel good about their manhood. And I think that was an accumulation of why, you know, I draped and I was sultry and smoky and all those adjectives that they described me as.
Were there a lot of talented but disgruntled actors in your films of the 70s, actors who felt that they wanted parts outside of black exploitation films but were having trouble landing them?
We're trying to get a part anywhere. You know, there weren't a lot of black roles for men or women, period, in films. And the subservient roles, we wanted to play leading people. We didn't always want to play the servants, the butlers, the maids, the submissive, the passive, always the supporting role. So we had a chance to play lead. We had a chance to play a doctor or a policeman or an industrialist in the black films, especially the ones in the 70s, detectives, people in charge of their own lives.
Did you go on a lot of auditions for other films in the 70s? Were there parts that you were interested in?
Many times I'd go on a lot a lot of roles, not only for myself and other actresses. I'm considered tall. I'm 5'8", and many of the actors are 5'8" also. So there was a part that I was supposed to play opposite Ben Vereen, and they really loved my work. However, we would see eye to eye, and if I put on shoes, I was looking down on him. And cinematically, it doesn't look like the ideal, you know, society's ideal image of a couple, the woman looking up and gazing up into the man's eye. So they wrote me a lovely letter and thanking me for my chest, and that I was wonderful and continued success, but I didn't get the part because I was too tall and that their star was diminutive. So That's happened a lot. And also, which is another factor which I brought up, I was speaking up at Harvard and Cambridge about 3 weeks ago. We had a seminar for the black film and law students at Harvard and the film school and law school at Harvard. And it was a four-day seminar, symposium. And we were discussing how African-American actresses and actors are categorized. The darker-skinned actresses, such as Whoopi Goldberg or Alfred Woodard, are considered the more ethnic. And the lighter-skinned ones, such as myself, Lynette McGee, Jennifer Beals, Paula Kelly, people that are a little bit lighter in skin are considered exotic. And we've gone from colored Negro, black, Afro-American, African-American now to exotic. And we were kind of discussing that because there was a part that I was up for to play Winnie Mandela. My South African accent was honed just right. My body movement, I played her very well, could play her on the stage. But when it came to playing her on film, it was a lot different. Because of probably my height, my skin color being light, and my features aren't as ethnic. So therefore, I didn't get the role, but I got to, you know, test a couple of times. And the same way for the role of Suge in The Color Purple, I tested 3 times for that, for Steven Spielberg and Ruben Cannon. However, you know, I had to have a certain look, which many of us don't have because of our ancestry. So therefore, you go in with not only 100%, you better go in with 150%, because after you start whittling away your height, your nose, your mouth, the color of your skin, you know, you're losing, and so you walk out with 50% chances left. And many of us don't get roles just because of those aspects, but that's the aspect of casting.
Well, you know, another thing that I think is interesting is that you've been a superstar among black filmgoers. Like among black filmgoers, especially younger ones who went to see all the action films.
That's so nice of you to say, the superstar.
Well, but yet on the other hand, there's so many people in the white film-going audience, who don't know you.
Yeah.
And it's I think an unusual position to be in, where you know you're a star in one community and not that well known in the other.
Well, you know, that's a microcosm and exemplifies our society because of who we value and who we don't, who we see and who we don't, out of sight, out of mind. On television, I'm quite visible to mainstream because of my role in Miami Vice, Crime Story, The Cosby Show, Frank's Place, Night Court. I do comedy as well. So I get a lot of fans. My visibility on television is really booming, and because of it, I have been offered, you know, a pilot, comedy pilot and a couple of dramatic pilots, and hopefully we can really hone them and develop them so we can, you know, get a go-ahead. And I've been asked to do a lot of pilots. And again, the factor is I'm either too light-skinned or too tall. But the honor is they respect you for your work, they like your work, they call you in and they call you back and they call you back and they try to figure out, where can you fit in? Will I wear flats on the show? Will I wear my hair frizzy or will I wear my hair straight? Because African-American actresses can go both ways with their hairstyle. And when I wear my hair very frizzy and curly, I look, of course, more ethnic. And when I'm out in the sun in the summer, I come in really, really dark. So it's interesting because I do get called in for different roles at different times of the year. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I just think that these are really interesting observations. I think one of the best performances that you've given that I've seen anyways, it was in Fort Apache, the Bronx, where you really stole the movie. You were a prostitute who was high on drugs and was a cop killer. You'd go up to cops who were parked in their cop car in deserted neighborhoods of the South Bronx, and you'd shoot them in the face, or in one scene you had a razor in your teeth, right, and you'd stick your head in the car, mm-hmm, and you just move your head from side to side and slash someone. And it's a really horrifying character.
Yeah, very horrific. Very.
And Pauline Kael described the performance as giving a feeling of obscene terror, which,
yes,
I think gets it pretty well.
Yes.
Tell me what you did to get into that character.
Well, I really did a lot of research on the streets in New York, and I met firsthand drug addicts. I went to shooting galleries. I met prostitutes on 25th and Lexington, and on 9th and 10th Avenue. I went to drug rehab centers. I read a lot of stories, but I just stayed up all night and just walked the streets with friends who helped me, other actors and people, so that we'd be all together and not be, our lives wouldn't be in danger.
Several of your films from the 70s, the blaxploitation films, have been issued on video cassette. Are you glad to have them available again? And do you think that they seem different now than they did at the time?
Oh, absolutely. And people are trying to say, they're campy, they're fun, they're this and that. And all they're doing is just going to a new audience, like 15, almost 17 years later. I really don't have any vision on them. I feel disconnected with them. I see myself in a certain type of role. I'm so distant from it. It's been so many years from it, and I've grown. Sometimes I feel like I'm watching a stranger in strange faces in this abstract form of art.
Well, Pam Grier, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, Terry Gross, thank you. This was really great.
Pam Grier is co-starring in the new film Class of 1999. It's a sequel to Class of 1984. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.